Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
You know, it's a bit of a shame that we got rid of the Penguins and Pirates part of our podcast because we almost had Penguins and Pirates this week because we were at the aquarium and we were on a boat. But we'll get to that in a second.
Right.
First, I want to read some feedback that we got from some listeners on our one of our most recent episodes, not last week, but the one before where we talked about Project Hail Mary. Both feedback we got on our SQPN YouTube channel. So we had some folks listen to us there. And the letter R. I'm trying to say it correctly. I'm not trying to say it like I'm not from Boston, because if I'm from Boston, I say ah.
R.
Ah on YouTube
R,
says.
R.
Anyway, ah says, I've just read Project Hail Mary following your review and really enjoyed it. Couldn't help but see other perhaps tenuous Christian references. Spoilers, folks, by the way. Not too much. I'll try to make sure we don't get spoiled too much. Rocky equals Petros equals Peter. Jonah being taken to where he doesn't want to go. There's even a prayer in chapter 19. Then there's death, resurrection, sacrifice, Moses, and the promised land. Any more? So, yeah, there is quite a lot, I have to say. There's quite a lot of Christian, you know, not that Andy Weir is necessarily putting it in there, but there's a lot you can find in there that has echoes from Christian theology. So it's hard to talk about it without spoiling it, isn't it?
Yeah, so I didn't even know.
Yes, we'll leave that as it is. And but thank you, R, for your feedback.
Yes.
You're right. You're totally right. Jeff Miller writes, the Kurt Jester, writes also on YouTube, who's in reference to my talking about the Netflix show Shadow and Bone. He says, I liked Shadow and Bone. Yes, YA tropes. The world building is the best part, and there are good performances. From what I read, the story is a merge from two of the series the author wrote in this universe. And I'm shocked you have seen no Studio Ghibli. Ghibli? I don't know.
I have no idea how to pronounce it.
I know. Mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Recommend to me something from Studio Ghibli that I should watch.
Oh, I've got a million recommendations. I'm not really a big fan of anime, so like the style kind of
holds you back.
Yeah.
The Star Wars anime coming.
Everyone says that like their films are the best, and one of these days.
The director of Luca, because that's where this reference comes from, directly referred to, no, it wasn't him, Stephen Gardanis referred to a Studio Ghibli that was really close to the story of Luca. I say Ponyo, maybe?
Ponyo's familiar name, yes.
Okay, anyway, recommend to me, folks. Also, Shadow and Bone, I've continued to watch it. It is pretty good. It got a little better. Still feels a little soap opera. Like, you know, not soap opera. Romance-y. You know what I mean?
You have a low tolerance for romance.
Oh, will she go for the boy she grew up with or the dark, mysterious man who she's just met? Oh, which one will it be?
Yeah, generally we don't watch romantic movies together because...
No. I mean, movies that have natural romantic things, that's fine. It's this artificial stuff, you know, like the Hunger Games. Oh, it's, what is it, Peeta, and I forget what the other one's name was, but you know, will she go with one or the other? Yeah. Anyway, but thank you, Jeff, for the feedback, and R, so both of you. So let's get into what we've been doing. We had a jam-packed show today. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get right into it. Tuesday every week is Scout Night for the girls. I take them to their scout meeting for the BSA Scouts girls troop, and the other three stay home with you. And it turns out you guys have a ritual or a custom or tradition on Tuesday nights.
I would say it's tradition.
tradition.
Because, you know, if you do one or something once or twice, then with it becomes kids. Tradition. Yes. Right, with kids. So, yeah, given that the big girls and you are gone, I'm left with the three little ones who are, well, they tend to be a little bit less.
Taking initiative and helping.
Taking initiative and helping with the cleanup and stuff. So one night, I didn't even remember how this started, frankly, but one night I had been showing, I had,
sorry,
it wasn't so calculated as okay. Like I had an idea and a plan. It was more just like happenstance. Like we'd been talking about some Looney Tunes and I was saying, oh, I should show that to you. And I said, but we've got to, you know, finish the dishes first. And so we finished doing the dishes and cleaning up. And then I showed them a
coyote, Roadrunner,
coyote, maybe something. It was like 5 minutes long and that was fine. And then the next week they were like, if we do the dishes, can we watch
more?
I'm like, okay, fine. And that, but then over time it's like grown to the point where like,
they're not just like, can we watch a bit? Like they're apparent, like you told me, they're diving in.
Right. I mean, there have been 1 or 2 weeks where they like they were playing outside and they forgot about it. And I was like, oh, it's too late. I'm sorry. You know, and that spurred them on even more the next week. And so they're like, OK, how quickly can we unload the clean dishes and then load the dishwasher with the dirty ones and tidy up the living room? And the three of them are like a whirlwind. It's amazing. And so, like, this past week was sort of exemplary. The dishwasher was still running with the clean dishes because we'd got it started late. But they tidied up the dining room table and, you know, moved everything to the kitchen and put the leftovers away. And then they watched 1 or 2 cartoons. And then I said, well, you could watch another one if you put away the clean dishes because now they're clean. And so then they ran off into the kitchen and they put away all the clean dishes from the dishwasher. And then they watched another episode. And they're like, can we watch another one? And I'm like, well, if you put the dirty things into the dishwasher, sure, you can watch another one. It's getting kind of late. But, you know, if you make it worth my while, I'll bend a little bit. And so they all three of them ran into the kitchen and put all the dirty dishes, loaded them into the dishwasher. Now, they
don't, like a mob boss.
Right. Now, they didn't do a perfect job. Like there was still some cleanup that I had to do when they were done. But the bulk of the work, the three of them had done. Well, I didn't have to do it all myself. So it's generally our pattern of bribery for chores. Like you get to watch something.
Screen time
for chores.
This goes right back to the benefit of restricting screen time. They only get to use an iPad or watch a video when they've done something to earn it. Really. Usually. I mean, sometimes it's you've had to endure schoolwork and sit at the table for a while, and now I need you to go over there out of my hair for a bit.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. For Ben, we've done sort of like you had to endure an unpleasant doctor appointment so you can have screen time. Right. But I think that's kind of earning it, too, because frankly. It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't wind through it, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, restricting the screen time for them has benefited us.
And I think that there's a long-term benefit. Like I think the fear of a lot of parents is if they're only doing chores when they get something out of it, then they're going to have an attitude of, well, I'm not going to work unless I'm going to get something out of it.
You mean like a paycheck? Because that's how, because I only work because I get a paycheck.
Right. I mean, there's that. But also, I you know, helping around the house is something that we do because
we're part of a family.
Part of a family, that sort of thing.
Right.
And honestly, so counterexample, was it Friday?
We weren't home Friday, but.
Thursday. It must have been Thursday, Wednesday. I don't know. One day this week, Ben decided that he wanted to clean his room. And so he.
Out of the blue. He was not ill.
Yeah, just like.
Well, he had a motive, but go ahead.
Random morning. I walk in and poke my head in the door and say good morning. And he is busy cleaning up his room. And now we've had this piece of furniture
toy
in their
furniture.
Room.
Yeah.
A play kitchen that we've had for
a dozen years. We had it when we moved in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, and it's you know, the kids have stood on it and to the point where it's
deteriorating.
It's falling apart. Like it's not something that we could pass on to another family for their kids to use. Like
and they don't play with it.
Way too beat up.
Yeah.
And they don't play with it. And it's taking up space in their room and it's gathering dust. And we had mentioned that, you know, it would be nice if we removed it. And under his own initiative, he got a screwdriver and he and Anthony set to work and Lucy set to work and deconstructed the whole thing.
Every screw, every bolt, every nut.
And there was nothing in it for them except the pleasure of getting the job done and having a tidy room afterwards.
Well, Ben did have a secondary motive.
Well, he had a motive, but no reward.
Right. There was no actual reward. That's true. Except praise, because we praised all of them up and down for their initiative and for doing it. And I think Ben, at least, I think he has his love. One of his love languages is praise.
Right. But there was no screen time in the offing from them doing that. That's my point is that they will still do things around the house without screen time.
Right. We have started to see more and more where they do a thing just because it needs to be done. So I think I don't think you need to worry so much about like, oh, they'll learn only to do things because they're going to get something out of it. I think it's a developmental thing. As you get older, you learn like, okay, when I was younger, I did things because I was rewarded. But as I get older, I do things because they need to be done. Like, But I've learned that things need to be done.
Right. And there's a training aspect. Learning how to do something is boring and you don't the intrinsic rewards are frankly harder for a child to grasp because the intrinsic reward of having a tidy room is not something that necessarily littler children value so much.
Mm.
But I think when they get older, they start to realize, you know, I have more fun when my room is tidy.
Yeah.
Which then he gets into the other motive that Ben had, which is that his birthday is coming up this week and he's anticipating getting presents.
Yeah, specifically.
Specifically, he's anticipating getting Legos and wants to have room in his room to build them. But again, he's made the connection that like when his room is tidy, there is room to play with things on the floor. And when it's a mess, there isn't. And so he recognizes that he wants to keep his room tidy. At least until his birthday when he can play with his new Legos.
And spread all the Legos all over the floor.
Meanwhile, he's been keeping his room pretty tidy all week since then.
Yeah. He's been cracking the whip on Anthony.
He has been.
Anthony's bed is pretty messy, but the floor has been pretty clean. That's good.
It's been impressive.
Yeah. So the big thing we did this week was Friday, our Cub Scout pack, one of the leaders, had contacted the ferry service for the Boston Harbor Islands ferry and gotten 50 free tickets to take us all out to an island in Boston Harbor and leave us there where we had to survive for. No, I'm just kidding. To take us out to George's Island, it's called, in Boston Harbor. It's part of the Boston Harbor National Recreational Area. So it's part of the National Park Service. And it's a historic Fort Warren that guarded the entrance to Boston Harbor starting at the War of 1812. And so we had to get, so we'll tell the story a little bit, but the frame of it is we all went into Boston, caught the ferry, rode the ferry out to the island and spent, you know, a good part of the day there, but we had to get there.
Right. So the thing is we have a
12 passenger van,
and it's tall.
Big Ford Transit, 6'11".
We know exactly how tall it is because a lot of parking garages in Boston are not
tall enough.
Most aren't even.
Yeah.
Most parking garages.
I looked at a lot of parking garages near the waterfront.
That sign on the front of the parking garage, which tells you how tall it is, that's really important, become really important to us since we became van owners.
Luckily, a lot of the websites actually tell you how tall it is.
Must be a frequent question.
Yes. So where a lot of the other families who can fit into a sedan or a minivan were going to drive in and park in the city for the day and hop on the ferry, that was not an option for us. And we looked at a lot of different options.
We did. We explored just about every.
Yeah. So there's a ferry that goes into Boston from a town near us that we, so we could, we would catch the ferry, go into Boston, then walk over to the other ferry that goes out to the island. In fact, the ferry from the town near us, actually, you could catch one that goes to the island that we were going to. And I'm like, why don't we just do that? Well, it turns out it's $10 each way per person, which for seven people comes out to $140, which would be a very expensive free trip to the island. So,
yeah.
So that turned out.
I was not ever clear on whether or not he could have got the free tickets from the Hingham Ferry.
From the first place. I'm not sure. Right. I think it's a separate vendor, like a separate ferry operator, Boston Harbor Cruises, whereas the one that goes from Hingham is operated by the MBTA directly, I think. I have to do more digging on that. But if we do this again and we can get them from Hingham, that's a much better deal than driving into Boston.
Well, I would think it would be a much better deal all around for everyone because it's a closer drive.
You don't have to drive into Boston. You could just drive to Hingham. It's just a lot closer and deal with the traffic going to the city. So we ended up taking, there's two different kinds of trains that you can go in. There's the commuter rail and the T, which is the subway. Both of them have stations near us. The commuter rail is in town. But the commuter rail doesn't run at the same. It's all a big thing. So we ended up taking the T, and we parked in the garage at our local station. And let me tell you, the garage is 7 foot.
So there's a 1-inch clearance.
I was waiting the entire time I'm driving.
Now,
through.
I've parked in this garage several times, so I in know that we can do it in the van.
Except they've renovated the garage, so you never know. They might have lowered or raised or something. It is so close. I would drive to the side of the lights and the signs as much as I could. It was very close. I drove slowly. I made sure the tires weren't overinflated.
Do you find yourself like instinctively ducking your head?
I'm waiting for the grind. That's what would. It's not so much like.
When I drive through there, I like duck my head as if that would help.
Yes. Of course. And so we ended up taking the T in, which was fine. It was 20 minutes, maybe half an hour. It was during the middle of what should be rush hour, but it's July 3rd on a rainy
Friday
of the 4th of July weekend. Nobody was going to Boston and post lockdown. So there's still a lot of people working from home. It was like a Saturday morning.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you see the T empty, like that empty.
Midday, like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Yeah. This was dead. So we got right into South Station, and then we had a walk from South Station up to Long Wharf, and that was about a 20-minute walk.
Mm-hmm.
And so the weather on Friday was not great. It was drizzly, rainy,
it was
cold. We 2 days before, it was 100 degrees and sunny.
See, I was thinking, I'm so glad it's not 100 degrees. Everybody else is like, it's wet, it's miserable. And I'm thinking,
there is like a range, like it would be nice if it were, say, 70 degrees and sunny. That would have been nice. But I mean, as it turned out, the drizzly wasn't bad and the cold wasn't that bad. We were prepared. Be prepared. Scott Motto. We dressed for the weather. We were fine. We walked up, got there in plenty of time. We were early.
Well, see, here's the thing is evidently Adam had padded it so that he told us to be there at 9:30. I thought that meant the ferry left at 9:30.
Yeah.
And in fact, the ferry left at 10. We got there at 10 to 9. We arrived at the wharf after a brisk walk.
Yeah.
At a quick pace. And then we had
an hour
and more than an hour to kill.
The boat left at 10. The boat was departing at 10. The boarding was started at 20 minutes till 10.
Right.
So we were there about an hour before we needed to board. So, yes, but we were an hour early.
We were an hour early.
Now, history tells us that having that added time for some of the families is necessary.
Yes.
Not us. We're usually on time for things. I mean, stuff happens, but
if I had known that Adam had padded it quite so generously, I would have taken a more leisurely stroll between South Station and right. Long Wharf.
It was a little tough on you there because of the you didn't have great shoes and stuff for that. But
yes, my feet were hurting.
I was trying to slow down for them. It's hard for me to slow down, but I tried to slow down for you. Usually you're the one way ahead. You get the long legs and the long stride.
Well,
but this time it was
I'm not as young as I used to be.
No. So while we waited, where we were sitting, waiting on Long Wharf, is right next to the New England Aquarium.
And the New England Aquarium is really nice in that it has an exhibit outside for people to look at while they're waiting to get in.
Right. So you don't have to pay anything.
Right. So basically a free exhibit of harbor seals.
Harbor seals. They've always been there since I was a kid. Yeah.
So there's 5 harbor seals in a big tank right there. And you can just walk up and watch them.
And they frolic and
they're awesome.
They do harbor seal things.
And we lucked out because I became after we'd been there for a while, like maybe 20 minutes, I noticed that a bunch of the seals kept swimming over and staring at the door.
the inner door.
Like there was one seal that had basically just parked itself in front of the door and was just staring, like waiting.
Looking at his watch.
Yeah, pretty much. So I said, you know what? I suspect that we're getting close to feeding time. And sure enough, very soon, the door opened and a couple of young women came out. And they stood around talking.
Yeah.
I think they were probably interns because they weren't doing much of anything except just sitting there talking. But eventually some more people came out and they had buckets of food and they had a big scale and
toothbrushes. They brushed the seal's teeth. Yeah.
So one seal was coaxed up onto the scale and several of them had their teeth brushed and it was really fun to watch.
Yeah. So that was good. And then eventually, as all the other scout families showed up, they all gravitated over there. And then we all got back together again. Oh, the fun thing was where I was sitting, I stayed with the bags so that they wouldn't have to carry their bags around. And so I didn't get to see the seals, but I've seen them a million times. But where I was sitting, there were some payphones and the kids were fascinated by them, including one payphone that somebody had ripped the front off of. So you could see the inner workings. And Anthony loved that. He liked, ooh, oh, yeah. Yes. Like, ooh. And of course, there was the bell and he kept binging the bell. Ding, 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 ding. Stop dinging the bell. So then we eventually, got the time came. We went over, we boarded the ferry, and the ferry was right next to these huge yachts. These like I don't know if they qualify as mega yachts. There was one that might have been a small mega yacht,
small mega yacht.
Yeah, but like,
is there a definition of mega yacht? A specific thing?
I think it's like anything over like a certain length. And there was one, like that one at the very end on the harbor side might have been, but the others were yachts. I mean, they were big, like the type of boat that has a dinghy that's the size of like a 20-foot power boat. You know what I mean? It has a crew and a captain. Like these were yachts and like out of Bahamas and Bermuda and Jamaica, like they had the flags and the,
oh yeah,
the, you know, the name of the port, the home port. I mean, these were beautiful multi-bazillion dollar yachts. So and then the ferry. And so we took and the ferry went out and took us about 40 minutes to get out there. And we went under the flight path to Logan Airport, which was fun. We saw the planes flying right overhead. And because it was low overcast, they came in pretty low.
Oh, yeah. Wild. Right. It felt like they were about to hit the top of the ferry.
Yep. And
we saw a harbor dredger and we saw a big container ship.
Yeah, with a Coast Guard cutter that had stopped it. And not much in the way of, we saw plenty of birds.
Yeah, we saw gulls and cormorants. Yeah. And
not much in the, like nothing in the water. We didn't see any seals in the water.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids spent a lot of time on the top deck outside and then came down and that sort of thing. And then we got out there. There's a visitor center on the island, which was nice. We went inside and I wanted to take a little time to kind of get a sense of what's going on here, what this is, that's a little bit of its history, you know. So it was built in 1812.
No, it was built in 1830.
I thought it was built for the War of 1812.
They might have fortified the island for the War of 1812, but the fort that's there was built in the,
okay,
was started in the 1830s.
Okay. But the location is important because while there's a whole harbor, there's the Narrows was the only channel, and it was only a 1,500 foot wide channel right next to it, was the only way into the inner harbor. So,
right.
So you couldn't sneak in. otherwise. But over the years, it became a, it was a prison, it was a Civil War prison.
And then in the First and Second World Wars.
No, the next island over, Pedix Island, was a POW camp for Italian POWs during World War II.
Right.
And there was a chapel there on that island. So, and Pedix Island, scout troops can actually get permission to camp there overnight, like on weekends, which we'll try to do sometime, which would be awesome. But they had, for a time in the 20th century, they had mines there. So they actually, the visitor center was the mine storage area. They had air defense missile batteries. So it was kind of cool. So we eventually went in and
into the fort.
And I would say, so it's a national park area. And I would say it's minimally conserved.
Very minimally. This fort.
There were parts of it that were definitely.
There were parts of it that were definitely not safe for people to be in.
Yes.
Where they were falling, you know, the bricks.
Walls had crumbled.
Walls and vaults had fallen in.
Yeah. Places like doors fenced off and, you know, boarded up. Don't go in here. And even the areas that were accessible were, like, some of them were clean, but they were pretty bare.
Yeah.
And
this,
dark.
This was not a terribly well.
This was not a set up for tourists.
Right. It's not a very interpreted site.
Yes.
I mean, other than the visitor center, which just has sort of a minimal amount of information. And there were warning signs in the fort, like.
Yeah. Don't go beyond this point. You will die.
Right. Pretty much.
Like, there were areas where, like, on the ramparts up above, like, don't go past this because it is a steep, like, you push through those bushes there, you're falling 50 feet to the moat or the ground or the rocks or whatever. I mean, we had to emphasize several times throughout that this is not a safe place.
It was exciting.
And there were some spooky parts. Like, there was a couple of places where you go down in the dark and you needed flashlights to get there. Like, there was no lighting.
Right. So fortunately, we were warned. And so the kids were all prepared. Well, and
we're scouts. We bring our essentials, and they include flashlights.
But they were specifically told to make sure that they had their flashlights with them. And that was a great call, because there were some places we couldn't have gone without flashlights. It was too dark.
Vaulted area with the tunnels we went down, and was it's like right out of a scary movie. Like, oh, and then we went into this room. Like, it must have been at one point, it was no windows all around, and it must have been like a magazine storage where they'd store weapons or something like that, or just supplies, whatever. But was it you that said to turn the lights off, the flashlights off?
Right. We had gone through several different turns since from the rooms that had windows and doors.
Yeah.
So we were
pretty far in.
Pretty far in underground, and there was no way light was getting through. And I wanted to see, like, how dark is dark?
Yes. So we all turned off our
lights. Everyone turns off the flashlights. They were off for less than half a second.
I had to turn it back on because Julie's one of the other scouts, she was kind of behind us, and she was kind of wandering around in the tunnel. I was afraid she'd walk past and get lost somewhere in the depths of the fort because she didn't have a flashlight. So it's like, so I turned it back on. But as soon as we turned them off, I think Julie turns and scared Sophie, and Sophie screamed so loud in this echoey place. I was kind of hoping we turn them off and I get down on the ground and grab someone's ankle. It would be really good.
See, I have childhood memories of touring Tom Sawyer's Cave in
Disney World?
No, Missouri.
Oh, the actual,
like,
Tom
Sawyer's Cave. The actual cave that inspired the
Mark
story.
Twain, yeah.
There was a point in the tour of the cave when they turned off all the lights and you're in the cave and, like, you could hold your hand in front of your face and you can't see a thing.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm still a little kid who just loves that. Like, the dark, the pitch dark, you can't see a glimmer of light anywhere dark.
Yeah, see, I'm like, mysterious world. I wonder if there's any ghosts in here. Civil War ghosts in the tunnels. I was just like, I was half expecting I'd turn a corner and see something. So, and because it was so rainy and dreary that day, it was kind of spooky, like added to the spookiness factor. So we went up on the ramparts, we went down below. I mean, it was kind of cool. I'd like to go there again.
Yeah, 10 out of 10 would go again.
Yeah. We ended up eating our lunch at this outdoor pavilion. It was kind of drizzly still. And then
it was wet.
I think everybody pretty much decided we were supposed to be there from like 11, the boat got in like at 10:45, and we're supposed to take the 3 o'clock ferry back. And I think pretty much everybody decided universally
we're
to
not
take
gonna,
the 1 o'clock ferry.
Yeah, we're not going to wait for the 3 o'clock ferry because we're done.
Yeah, we were all kind of wet and had seen enough. We were satisfied. If it had been a better day, I think we would have spent more time.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't that much more to see. I think we could have like
wandered around more.
Yeah, spent more time wandering around the island and let the kids run around and throw rocks.
We didn't talk about the birds
at all. Oh my gosh, the birds were amazing. There were so many swallows. I think they must have been nesting. Well, you know, we know that they were nesting inside the fort because we saw a bunch of nests.
With chicks in them. It was the cutest thing.
But, I mean, hundreds of swallows.
Yes.
They were all over the place.
And they get so close to you, they swooping past you.
Yeah, it was amazing. I've seen swallows before. I've never seen them in those numbers.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. There was a lot of them. And probably other seabirds at other times as well, or you know, like birds that near the coast.
Yeah, it was a great place for birding.
Yeah. So on a clear day, it would have been a great view of the city of Boston, and you could see over to Hull, which is a place that we're familiar with, and I'll talk about in a second. It was like right there. So on a clear day, the views would be amazing, but not so much. And there's other islands you can visit. Spectacle Island has the lighthouse where back in the mid-20th century, two keepers' families lived there on the island with 19 kids on this one little lighthouse island.
I mean, the nice thing about being there on a really cloudy day was that we actually saw the lighthouse, like being a lighthouse, flashing through the fog, which was kind of cool.
Yeah. We weren't the only ones there, but it was a small crowd that day. There was not a lot of people. It was not crowded at all. It was pretty light crowd.
Yeah, I mean, there was our 50 people and maybe like another
15,
dozen
20,
or
yeah.
so.
So we ended up taking the boat back. That was fun, too. We saw some cool things. There was a boy who came up to us. He wasn't part of the scout troop. It must have been with his family. I get the feeling he was like on the spectrum, you know, or socially awkward anyway.
I thought he was just being chatty.
His social skills were very off norm. Like he'd come up and talk to you about, like he was about 12 or 13 and just kind of start rambling at you. like the rambling at strangers sort of social awkwardness sort of thing. Like with all of his, you know, like an info dump of everything he knows about everything. Yeah. Anyway, he was a nice kid, and he ended up interacting with the other kids.
I didn't realize that he wasn't part of the group. I just assumed that everybody knew him because they were all chatting with him.
No, he was just a kid. I mean, our kids are nice to stranger kids. I mean, that's they're welcoming and open to kids they don't know. So, we came back in, and I had the idea that we're based on where the ferry docks. I said, let's walk across the street into Boston and go to Quincy Marketplace in Faneuil Hall. And Quincy, if you're not familiar with Quincy Marketplace.
I thought that was my idea.
No, it was mine.
It was mine.
No. I'm certain this was my idea. I really, really was my idea.
I think we both came up with the same idea at the same time.
Anyway, so the...
Wait.
Are we going to resolve this somehow? We're both convinced of our rightness. I think it bears no...
That's where you say, yes, we must have both come up with it at the same time.
Sure. So we, if you're not familiar with Boston at all, Quincy Marketplace and Faneuil Hall are a heavily tourist area, a historic area in the city, and they're very old. They go back to, you know, over, I think, 200 years at this point. In fact, Faneuil Hall goes back even longer to the Revolutionary days.
Yeah, Faneuil Hall has, like, played a not...
Important roles.
Not an unimportant role in the Revolution and like a meeting place.
Some of the big important meetings took place in Faneuil Hall for the beginning of the Revolution. And Quincy Marketplace has always been literally that. It's a marketplace and there would be stalls and vendors and stuff. Today it's mostly touristy and inside are all these different food vendors, little food stalls, food
it's like
of every kind you can
imagine.
It's
like a food court on steroids.
Yes. And, you know, you got seafood, you got Indian, Chinese, of course, pizza, some of the best pizza, you know, all the barbecue, everything you can imagine.
Sushi, gourmet mac and cheese.
Right. Just like, and then the desserts. So the idea was to get, you notice how I did that? The idea was to get clam chowder. after because it was cold, it was rainy, it was wet, and a nice bowl of clam chowder would be hit the spot, New England clam chowder. So we went over, got, so there's seven of us. I'm like, how many should we get? I'm kind of like, and it was, we'd had lunch, but it was a, you know, busy day, sea air, work up the appetite. I figured, let's get, say, five bowls of chowder.
But we forgot to take into account the fact that the kids had been pretty much snacking nonstop on the ferry.
Right. On we made sure they brought plenty of snacks. So we could have got away with three because even Sophie didn't finish her bowl. It was so, I ended up eating basically three bowls of chowder. It was a lot. It was really good. And Lucy didn't want anything to do with chowder, and we got her some french fries, and those were good too. So that was good. So that was a nice, warm, you know, filling sort of thing there. They were really tired, and we had a long walk back to South Station. So we walked through the Rose Kennedy Greenway, which is a park that's a sort of a necklace park, I think they call it.
Basically, Boston used to have a major highway that ran through the city.
An elevated highway called the Central Artery.
Which was I-93. So it's a major interstate highway. They buried it.
In the Big Dig. You certainly, if you've heard anything about Boston, you've heard about the Big Dig.
Right. It took them like, what, 20,
30 years.
30 years?
Yeah, so it was supposed to be 15, but, you know, government.
But then afterwards, when they pulled down the elevated highway, there was this big strip of, well, basically wasteland in the middle of the city.
So what
do
we do with it? Let's build buildings, some people said. And other people said, let's build parks. And that they had the better of it.
I am so glad that they did, because I remember when I first moved to Boston, the Central Artery was there and it was this big, ugly thing. And I remember, you know, walking underneath it to get to the North End. And it was just this big.
And it really split the city in half. It really separated the waterfront from the rest of the city.
Right. And now it's this beautiful park.
That, right. With art installations and fountains.
And it's, you know, blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of park.
Yeah.
So it's this big, beautiful green
area.
There's
a beer garden there.
Yeah, there's
when that reopens, I want to go check it out.
Flower gardens and lawns and fountains, and
they have like at some times of the year, like all, you know, again pre-lockdown, and I'm sure it'll be back. They would have they had this one whole lawn full of hammocks that anyone could lay in. You know, it's a lot of fun and it's pretty. So we walked through the Greenway on the way back because we were taking our time more. And then rode the train back. You and I both, well, I was fighting to stay awake.
I was absolutely out.
I think you lost
out.
That battle.
I did not win the battle to stay awake.
I did not want to be like the two parents who fell asleep on the train as their kids, you know, were among strangers.
Although, I mean, the nice thing is that we are the last stop on that train. So if you do fall asleep, you won't miss your stop.
Oh, I think there was a guy who did. Who missed his stop. Like I saw him like at, I think in Quincy somewhere, he jumped up. He's like, oh no, dang it. Ah!
Like, oh, I missed that.
Yeah, and he's like, he had to get up for the next stop and he must have like run back to the other one.
I've done that. I've missed my stop before.
I've done it too. I did it too. Luckily it was not on the line that went to Providence, Rhode Island.
I missed my stop on the last train out of Rome.
Ooh.
And it was the last train of the night.
Oh, yeah, I remember you telling me about this. And like a stranger gave you a ride home?
Yes, I in my very, very broken Italian, I asked everyone around me on the train, you know, where Manziano was. And this very helpful lady says, kind of points backwards, like, we've passed it. And I must have looked horrified. And I'm like, oh, no, how am I going to get back? Like, I don't have money for a taxi. I don't even know how to order a taxi. And she very calmly, quietly, slowly explains to me that her husband has a car and that he's picking her up at the station and they will drive me back. And it was probably, I mean, they probably went half an hour out of their way to drive this poor American student back to campus. So,
I mean, as a parent now of a young woman, like I can just picture that happening to Bella and oh my gosh, that makes me nervous. So I'm not going to think too much about it.
But you anyway. Know, there are wonderful, nice people everywhere. And yes. These people were very
guardian
very,
angels,
very kind,
guiding us to them. So that was our George's Island day. And then we were too exhausted to make dinner. So it was like, you guys find leftovers and eat them.
I think everybody managed to find something to eat.
Yeah, I think Anthony made quesadillas.
Which I think, you know, is fair because I made most of their sandwiches for the field trip. So they usually make their own lunches.
Yeah.
So this was just a swap.
So, and then quickly, today is Independence Day. It's the 4th of July. We were supposed to go to my brother's house for a pool party, but the rainy weather continued. It's amazing. It was like a week of 90 plus weather, including one day that it reached 100. And then it's been 4 days of cold, wet, rainy, high of 65 one day. Like, it was like a 40 degree difference in the high temperatures. It was like the highest high ever in June and the lowest high ever in July or something like that. Anyway, so instead of that, we stayed home today, and the weather, by dinner time, it was starting to turn nice. The clouds just cleared. So I got the fire pit going and I cooked some burgers and hot dogs. We ate dinner outside and then watched the neighbors' fireworks up till just right before we started recording. Because our neighbors all go all, even though fireworks are illegal in Massachusetts, our neighbors don't seem to care, and they entertain the kids, and we don't have to drive anywhere and sit in a crowd to watch them. So, and then we'll have the pool party tomorrow. The pool party had been postponed, so that'll be nice.
But we had, you know, I made pecan pie, and we had watermelon, and
yep,
it felt 4th of July.
It was celebratory. Yeah. So let's talk about what we've been eating. You made a pecan pie today, and you also made a key lime pie today.
Right. The key lime pie hadn't set by dessert time tonight, so it'll be for tomorrow.
Nice. We're not taking that, are we?
No way. It would be like disappear in 5 seconds, and then we'd be lucky to each get.
There's like 100 people at my brother's party. So, right. Yeah.
I will bring food. I am not going to bring my key lime pie.
Okay.
I'm not that generous. Sorry.
So. And then what, because of all the rain, I haven't been doing much grilling. We've just been, you know, catching as catch can for dinner. But we did get in one night where I was able to make bratwurst and Italian sausages on the grill. And it was your preference because you prefer bratwurst.
I had picked up the bratwurst last time I was at Whole Foods because
right.
Our Stop and Shop doesn't usually carry bratwurst for some reason.
It does. It's just in a different section. It didn't did before.
No. They sometimes have it. When they do have it, it's in a different section, but they often don't have it.
Okay. I've seen it a lot. I just haven't bought it. And for some reason, it's not with the Italian sausage. I don't know why they put it in a different place. Anyway, we had it, so I was going to make it. And I know that when you make bratwurst, you're supposed to parboil it in beer before putting it on the grill. And so I did that with that, and I made some Italian sausage with it because I didn't know if the kids would want bratwurst. And it was really good. Like, the problem with grilling the Italian sausage is it will tend to, unless you're very, very careful, it will tend to burn and char on the outside before it's cooked on the inside. And the kids don't like that. I don't mind it. I'm used to it. But the kids don't really like that. But this way, it actually was, so I parboiled it in the beer, threw it in the, once it was had reached temp, it was done, it was cooked, just throw it on to get some color.
Right.
And then they were really good. I was like, even the Italian sausage, too. I got to say, that's how I want to make it from now on.
Beer
solves everything.
I tell you.
It doesn't even have to be really good beer. I mean, I wouldn't really actually use really good beer. But
I love bratwurst so much.
Yeah.
It's my favorite sausage. I mean, other sausages are okay, but bratwurst is.
I know.
It's my jam.
A lot of people prefer bratwurst over Italian sausage. Italian sausage is what I know, but. Yeah. So, all right. And that's pretty much it for food and cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had curry, we had hot hamburgers and dogs, and we had, you know, the usual things. So nothing too exciting. I promise we'll have some more exciting things this week.
Maybe.
To talk about. Yes. Well, I'm planning it. We'll put it that way. I've already got the menu figured out. All right. So let's talk about what we've been reading or watching. I want to mention just two things. I've finished reading Tom Clancy, the new Tom Clancy novel. Tom Clancy has died in 2013, but his characters live on, being written by other authors, and there's a new author that picked up the Jack Ryan Jr. series called Don Bentley, and it was really good. I think he might be the best so far who've been writing these ones, and I really like that the character, so Jack Ryan is Tom Clancy's main character. He's the one that was in Hunt for October. Now he's the president of the United States and older, and he's not running around doing spy stuff, but his son is now a spy. And there's something very interesting about how the character is, you know, early 30s, I think is what they have him as now, and is really starting to wrestle with the questions of marriage and family. you know, in settling down and having, like, seeing what his parents have and why don't I have that? I thought I'd have that by now. And it's interesting to see in a spy thriller novel, a character who is thinking about, you don't usually see that. Usually the spy is like the lone wolf, the ladies man, you know, the James Bond or the, you know, the Jason Bourne or, you know, that sort of thing. And
although Jason Bourne becomes married man in the books.
I just realized that. Yes. but in the movies, he settles down for a bit and then she dies.
They ruined Jason Bourne in the movies.
Yeah.
I loved the books.
Yeah.
The movies just didn't do him justice.
Right. I know. Although Matt Damon was pretty good.
I mean, Matt Damon was good. I mean, I felt like they ruined
it. He should have been a different character, not Jason Bourne.
Well, or they should have stuck to the original story, because Matt Damon could have done a great job with that, where Jason Bourne settles down and has a family, and then he gets sucked back into the spy business. But as a family man, why did they have to kill Marie off? I'm so mad about that.
Fake drama. Anyway.
Yeah.
So Jack Ryan, Target Acquired, was good. So,
okay.
All right. So then I watched the new Amazon Prime movie called Tomorrow War, The Tomorrow War, starring Chris Pratt. And I've also watched the, the pitch meeting video on that. I watched it before when I was making dinner tonight. It was so on target. There were so many plot holes in this. So the premise is that 30 years from now, aliens have invaded and are wiping out humanity. And so our future generation has figured out time travel, and they come back to recruit us, to recruit people to go fight in the war in the 30 years from now. And so they start taking people for 1 week enlistment, and not just soldiers, like random people that they have choosing based on criteria, quote unquote. And it's like the big plot hole is instead of, like, because there's only 500,000 people left, we've lost. Why are we taking our people and sending them 30 years in the future to fight the losing war? Maybe now that we know it's coming, we can prepare and stop the aliens before. Wouldn't that be a better use of our resources? Or to, like, bring all those people back and they can be here with us? Like, it didn't make any sense. Like, there's a dozen, like, things that don't make sense. So you suspend all your disbelief and enjoy the ride.
All right.
So it's a story, but it's really a story of fathers and children and family, fathers and their children and family. Uh-huh. Chris, you know, the Chris Pratt's character and his daughter and his relationship with his dad, who he's been estranged from. It's all the expected beats, but there are some unexpected turns. Like, just when you think, okay, this is the end of the movie, no, it keeps going, and then there's a new thing. So there's that. J.K. Simmons is really great. He's one of my favorite actors, it turns out.
I don't know J.K. Simmons.
So he's a character actor, has been in a bunch of different things. He was in a show recently that was on Showtime, I think it was, a science fiction show called Counterpart, which I know you didn't see, but which I really liked. But he was J. Jonah Jameson in the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. Here's a picture of him. You can see him, Melanie, but if Google his name, J.K. Simmons. You've seen him in a bunch of things.
I'm not wearing my glasses. I can't see him.
I'm trying to think of some things he's been in that you might have seen. But do you remember the Patriots Day?
Patriots Day?
The movie about the marathon bombing?
I didn't see that.
Oh, I thought you saw that with me. Okay, no. That was good. Yeah, I can scroll through that and you'd see it, but he's been in hundreds of different things.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Anyway, one of my favorite actors. And so he was really good in it. This is Yvonne Strahovski from Chuck. She was the female spy in Chuck. She was in it. I hadn't seen her in ages. Lots of gory alien stuff, like aliens exploding.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, that's fun. Like I said, some head-scratching plot decisions, like, let's take all of these old people of all fitness levels and abilities with 1 week training for 1 week of duty in the future. And by the way, we're not even going to bother to give them uniforms. We're just going to throw them in there in the clothes that they showed up in. And they're drafted, so they have no choice.
That sounds like a really bad idea.
It's kind of like,
and if you die, dumb. If you die in the past, or you're
die in the
dead,
future.
Dead.
You die
I mean,
in the
you
future.
Die in the future.
You're dead. And it's like 80% casualty rates.
So all these people are just, like, disappearing and nobody...
Not just disappearing. They're being drafted with the cooperation of our government.
No, but
They're going into the future and not coming back.
But from the point of view of people here nowadays, like...
Our governments are cooperating with it, with the future people.
Do regular citizens know? Like,
yes. Yes, okay, it's a worldwide announcement. Everyone knows.
Okay, this is not like a secret
plot. No.
Like, they're...
No, this is not secret at all. It's like they... Because the future people showed up in the middle of the World Cup soccer match. Not the Super Bowl, of course, but the World Cup, so everybody in the world would be watching, except for all the Americans who weren't watching, apparently. And they showed up in the middle of the World Cup and made their announcement, and, you know, they show up, like, through a time portal, so it's, you can't ignore it. And so all the world governments are cooperating and sending people into the future, and...
Just random people, not, like, soldiers? Not, like, people who are trained?
Right.
Why?
Well, there's one criteria for going in, which is that to avoid the time paradox, you have to already be dead 30 years from now. You have to have died in between. So they're only taking older people, except remember that one key thing I pointed out. In the future, everyone's dead. There's only 500,000 people left. So everybody's dead.
So why couldn't they take the just soldiers? The soldiers?
Right. Instead of sending, like, for 1 week tours, send them for however long it takes. Like, for 6 months or a year. Like, why is it 1 week? It didn't make sense. It really didn't. It's kind of, yeah, if you dig too deep. But the following the characters where it was pretty, I mean, it's, you don't think too much about it. It's a hack and slash blow up the aliens sort of movie.
Right.
Yeah. That at one point, they find the nest and they have the toxin they have to inject into them to kill them all. This is a little bit of a spoiler. If you don't want to hear it, don't just skip ahead, but it doesn't matter, just because you're going to watch the movie anyway. So they're going to inject a toxin, and then something goes wrong, and they start, the aliens wake up and start attacking them. And as they're getting killed, we're like, well, just blow up the C4 and we'll all die in a fireball with the aliens. And it's like, wait, you have C4? Why do you go through the effort of injecting them with the toxin? Just blow them up with a C4 in the first place and not be in there when it blows up so that nobody has to die. Like, that didn't make any sense. Somebody was not thinking that through. Anyway, the video on the pitch meeting video was really funny, and I'll link to it in the show notes.
I love pitch meeting.
Pitch meeting is the best. Super easy, barely an inconvenience. All right, so that's what I've read and watched. What have you read?
Okay, let's see.
You want me to remind you of the two?
No.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Okay.
So I read a couple of short, like, juvenile novels. One of them, whose name I can't even remember. It was like, it turned out to be the middle one in a series, which I would love to read the series, but I think they're all out of print and our library doesn't have them. But then I also read one called The Watsons Go to Birmingham, which is set in 1963, and it's a family, an African-American family living in Flint, Michigan, but the dad's from Flint, and the mom is from Birmingham, and the older son is a bully and getting into trouble, and so they decide to take him to Birmingham to spend the summer with grandma to kind of set him straight, because grandma seems to be a first disciplinarian. But then when they get there, things don't go as planned. I did not really like the first half of the book because it is a bully story. It's told from the point of view of the middle child who kind of looks up to his older brother, but mostly is scared of him because he's a bully, not only to other kids at school, but also to the younger brother. I mean, he has a few redeeming features in that he's sort of like, I get to beat up my younger brother and be mean to him, but nobody else can. So he does kind of like
protect him,
but he's not nice. I mean, you kind of want him to like go have to spend the summer with grandma because you really just, I didn't like him at all. And there's a little sister too, but the second half of the novel, and especially like the last quarter of the novel, was really good. Like, I loved the resolution. It gets almost like a sort of magical realism kind of feel to it. The sister is supposed to be in the church that gets bombed. I mean, you know about the bombing in Birmingham in 63. Yes. The
right.
The little girls die. So at first you think, oh, no, she's going to be one of the little girls who's dead in the church. It turns out she's not, though she was there in the church before the bomb went off. But how she gets saved is kind of like a nice plot twist that really worked well.
Okay.
So I liked it. Okay. It's not one I'm going to read out loud to the kids because I hate reading stories with bullies.
Right.
I don't like them.
So,
and then the kids and I started to read a nonfiction book called The Brendan Voyage, which is, we've only read the first two chapters, but so far it's really gripping and it's very well written. And so basically in the 70s, this guy who's a sailor and something of a historian gets interested in, I guess he's interested in historic voyages, and his wife is a medievalist who's interested in historic manuscripts. And they both come to the conclusion over dinner one night that there's something very interesting and odd and unusual about St. Brendan's voyage. His wife points out that the manuscript is really strangely detailed with a lot of things that don't feel like other medieval fabulous tales, that there's a lot of really concrete information as one would expect from a traveler report. And he says, I really want to know, like, whether it's possible. Like, at first he thinks there's no way you could actually make it across the Atlantic in a leather boat. But he decides there's only one way to find out, which is to
do it,
to build the boat and sail the route. It's really, really well written. Like, it opens with the boat 30 miles off the coast of Ireland in a storm.
Yeah.
And wow, just what a great way to open, like in the middle of the storm in a small boat. I kept thinking about it while we were on the ferry, especially when we got to some of the like choppier bits, and thinking, imagine doing this in a small leather boat.
Right.
And this was like, you know, in the harbor.
It kind of reminds me of Thor Heyerdahl in the Voyage of the Kon-Tiki.
Right. There were several different historic, like, recreations of historic journeys in small craft.
Right.
Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki is one of them. The Brendan Voyage is another. And there was another one where they, not too long ago.
The Viking one, right?
Well, there was a Viking ship one. But then in the Pacific, there was, like, sailing out of Hawaii, there was a reconstruction of a, like, the rafts that they use in Moana, there was an actual voyage where they...
Well, so Kon-Tiki was a South Pacific one as well.
Right.
They sailed from South America to the Tuamotu Islands, 8,000 kilometers across the Pacific, in 1947. But yeah, there was a more recent one that, yes.
Like in the last decade.
That left from Hawaii, and it was about, trying to recreate using the Polynesian maps.
Right.
Yeah.
The charts.
Yep, I remember that.
It's a genre I love. I love historic sailing stories.
Yeah.
And these kind of recreations where they're like, there's no way anybody could do this. Oh, yeah? Let's show you.
Watch me.
It's great. So I am looking forward to reading this out loud with the kids. The kids are really into it.
Awesome.
I'm probably more into it than they are, but they're into it.
They'll get into it. Awesome. So, good. That's what we've been reading and watching. Let's talk a bit about today's gospel readings. I missed the beginning of the homily today because a child needed to use the bathroom at the church. But you told me that I didn't miss much except a little talk about Independence Day.
Yeah, what you missed was the discussion of Independence Day, really. Okay. Like,
so
the holiday.
As a refresher, the readings for this week were, Ezekiel 2, where, as the Spirit of the Lord spoke to me, the Spirit entered me and set me on my feet. Son of man, I'm sending you to the Israelites, rebels who have rebelled against me. They and their ancestors have revolted against me to this very day, and so forth. So I'm sending you among them as a prophet to this rebellious house. The second one reading was St. Paul talking about the thorn in the flesh that was given to him, an angel of Satan, to keep him from being too elated, is the translation. Three times I begged the Lord about this, that it might leave me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, which I think is a great line. And then, of course, the gospel is Jesus going back to preach in his home synagogue and people going, who does he think he is? He's the son of Mary and Joseph. We know him. We know his family. And they threw him out. And that's where we get a prophet is with, not without honor, except in his native place.
Yeah. So Father started off by talking about the theme of rejection.
Opposition and rejection. Yes.
Right. That
Ezekiel was rejected.
Jesus is rejected.
Right. And Paul wasn't so much rejected as made weak to keep him humble, which I think is an interesting coincidence, by the way, as Pride Month ended, we were talking about keeping humble. I just thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, the theme of humiliation of God's messengers, you know, and of God himself as in Jesus. It's interesting that Jesus says in the gospel, he was amazed at their lack of faith at the people. He was amazed. Like he was surprised, like amazed as in surprised.
Or just is it an amazing amount of
lack of faith based on what? I mean, it's one of the things that makes me think of is just how hard it is to preach the gospel. Like, especially in from the this gospel message, when people know you. Now, Jesus, of course, is perfect. But when people, like, to preach it to people who know you really well. Father says, like, when you've, you know, if I'm preaching to my friends, and we were just out drinking the other night, and they're going to go, yeah, look, you're talking so holy now, but we saw you the other night. We know you who you really are.
Right. And he mentioned that, in fact, I thought this was an interesting point that I hadn't really thought of before, but he mentioned that people in Nazareth might well have remembered that there was something a little bit iffy about Jesus and like Mary and Joseph and the whole
when he was born and when Mary and Joseph were married
and when they were married. And maybe some people were kind of counting on their fingers and thinking those dates are a little bit tight.
They don't really add up.
Yeah. And so maybe there was a sense of like there was a whiff of scandal and that maybe had attached to his family.
Well, and the classic Mary thinks she's so holy. She thinks she's so good and so much better than us. Can you imagine?
I don't think that they.
Oh, I could totally see human nature being what it is, where people going like, look how, you know, the ice cream won't melt in her mouth. I mean, she's so, you know, so good. She's too good.
Yeah, but I don't think she thinks. I mean, I don't.
No. She was people perceiving that of her in any case.
And of course, then there's all the time that they'd spent in Egypt, which also might have sort of been the like you spent that much time in a foreign land. Like.
Yeah. At a time when all those babies were being killed, you know. Right. So I could see there being questions and suspicions and looking askance at this weird family.
Not to mention that, you know, again, where does he get all this knowledge from? I mean, at first they're amazed, like, where is he coming up with this stuff?
And the miracles.
Right. And he's not, you know, he's not from one of these priestly families.
He's not like important.
Scribe.
He's not wealthy. He's not from a, you know, a rabbinical family. He's just a carpenter. You know, could you imagine, you know, the truck driver getting out of his truck and speaking like this and performing miracles? People like, who's he? He doesn't have a theology degree. He's not been ordained, you know? He's not a Jesuit. It's yeah, I can see that. It's interesting, like, and I think what it's telling us is you're gonna get rejected. I mean, this is the whole thing. Just because you have the good news, because you have the truth, you could do miracles. You could cure people from illnesses. And they'll still reject you. They'll still hate you. They'll still throw you out. Even Jesus was thrown out of his own town by his people. You know, they were going to throw him from a hill. Remember that? That's from a different gospel, but they were going to throw him off a cliff.
Right.
So we can't expect any better. So, and then, and Paul says, I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and constraints for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong.
That's one of my favorites. I mean, I love the paradoxical nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also the idea that we don't have to be strong. Like, we don't have to be.
Well, it's the anti-health gospel, isn't it? you know, what's his name down in Houston preaching, you know, God loves you because you're strong and wealthy and you have all these material blessings. That means God loves you and you're doing his work. And that's not what Paul says.
When I am weak, then I am strong.
Yeah. My God says to him, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness.
Which is, you know, how God himself appears to us, not as a great king, but conquering with armies, but as a baby.
It's one of the few times that Paul quotes God saying something to him. He's literally saying, God said to me, quote, my grace is sufficient for you. I think that's significant. There's not a whole lot of times where Paul does that. I'm not even sure how often, but it makes it a very significant verse. Yeah. So good readings and appropriate for Independence Day, America. Think about, our pride that needs to be sometimes tamped down a bit, the reality that's thrust at us. But even as Christians in America today, our message is not welcomed in many places. But, they didn't welcome Jesus. So just something to think about. Anyway, I think that should do it. We've gone long. We talked a long time about our trip to George's Island, so we should probably cut things short here. We do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Lewis M., Adam H., Philip M., Dennis M., and Rebecca C. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets on all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And just as a reminder, SQPN is a 501c3 nonprofit. We are a Catholic apostolate. Our mission is to spread the gospel through podcasts, and you're helping us do that. So that's it from us. So what did you think of our discussion? You can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. I'll put links from our discussion in our show notes on sqpn.com. And remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Retweet us on Twitter where we're at SQPN and leave us comments wherever you find us. Until next time, I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.